20th century and one of the most prolific, releasing over 60 albums. Zappa burst onto the music scene with Freak Out, the debut album of his band, The Mothers of Invention. For over 3 decades, he regaled us with his Gail Zappa, along with their 4 children, has continued to keep his spirit and message alive into the present. Gail Zappa speaks with Rebecca Novick about the legacy of the man who was never afraid to speak his mind.
You often hear people say about Frank Zappa that he was different from the people of his time and that he was ahead of his time. In what ways was he different?
One notable way is that he was the most present person I've ever known. And I think that if more people were present more often, there'd be a lot less suffering in the world.
And how would that work?
Because if you're present, you're not dwelling in the past and kind of going over all the wrongs that have happened to you. And, you know, just becoming more and more obsessed with that, and trying to look for payback and all that sort of thing. And we're not here very long. And while we're here, there's just one present. Everything is now.
Is that, do you think, where some of his humor came from, this ability to be in the present?
Yeah, because I think if you're in this day and this time, if you are, very present, if you're really involved with reality, you have to be an absurdist by definition.
Was it fun being around him because of that? His ability to be able to tap into that? And
well, yeah, and it's inspiring, and it kind of makes the workday go faster. He also said, you know, you have to earn the right to be bored, and people should pay more attention to that because there's just so many experiences and so many responsibilities that people just take for granted. And if they paid attention, then they could really have a feast getting really, really bored and then understand what there is to be truly angry about.
So there was a seriousness to his humor as well. He was making a point.
Oh, he didn't get around.
Yeah. And what do you think were the things that he was really passionate about and that he really felt strongly about getting out there?
Freedom. I mean, having a free mind, having the right to say whatever you want as an artist, the right to say, to express yourself in any way that you felt was appropriate as an artist. But certainly, you know, he loved this country. He was truly a patriot. He believed in the idea of democracy and freedom of speech and freedom to hear and freedom to listen and freedom just to, you know, use those cells that you have collected inside your cranial cavity for some good purpose.
Your brain?
Yeah, those things, you know.
and he did take this on, right, with Tip O'Gore and the whole parental advisory issue.
I just think it comes with the territory. So if you're going to stand up for that and no one else is, that's what you get. You know, nothing happens in the universe without an equal and opposite reaction. So when you have to deal with things of that nature and you set up a force field, you attract the elements that are opposed to that. So
he was a strong force field.
Yeah, I think so. You attract the things that are against you, but you also attract the things that are for you. And I think that it's really important for people to speak up in the sense that there's a lot of people that will never be able to do that or never be in a position where what they do will make any difference to anyone other than themselves. But I think you have to take that on as an individual. And when you hear somebody else's voice out there in the wilderness, it feels really good to know they're speaking for you.
John Cleese once said, he was asked in an interview, is there anything that you wouldn't make a joke about? Any subject that you would veer away from? And he thought for a while and he said, no. I don't think there is. And I want to kind of ask you the same question in terms of freedom of expression. Is there any area that you feel should be restricted?
No. Absolutely not. I mean, I can tell you this. For my children who had to grow up with people who believed in the concept of there being bad words that you could say that could hurt people, Frank was very clear, and what we used to tell our children is there is no such thing as a
steps they've taken very strongly in their own lives, freedom of expression, and they're, number of them are musicians, so they've obviously taken that legacy.
Oh, yeah, any number of them are musicians at any time. No, they are. I mean, but they're stuck with that. That's what you come into this world with. I mean, if you deny who you are, you're going to be in deep doo-doo.
Well, is it true that the hospital refused to put Dweezil on the birth certificate?
Yeah. And they wouldn't let me name Moon Moon. And I mean, if from day one, they've been up against it because of their last name, not their first.
What would your husband have made of this whole movement of political correctness?
I think that he made it already. Everything he said is still coming true. I mean, this is the problem with people who are in their time and can see vast patterns over great distances of time and space. Pretty much he had it together. He told us then, and it's still happening. So you can check out his records anytime and find out that, unfortunately, he's still right.
Do you think he would be even more political than he was?
Well, he was going to run for president, you know, so.
Really?
That's pretty political. Yeah, but had he run, I don't think we would be in the situation we're in now, but this is all mere speculation, you understand.
Would you think people would appreciate him in the same way?
Well, on all of his concerts, one thing you have to appreciate is that all it kept getting older, but it always stayed just as young. So there were always the 17-year-olds that were showing up at every concert, even as the rest of us were getting ancient. So, yeah, I think there was he's the guy that, you know, said the thing that you wish you would have had the balls to say had you been in that situation. And we got fan letters from people who were in their 80s as much as he got fan letters from people who were in their teens.
Really?
Because the older people knew that he was telling the truth, you know, and the younger kids he was telling them, along with his peers, you know, a lot of stuff that they needed to know about what was socially acceptable behavior in a situation where you didn't have the experience. You could rely on somebody else's experience, and he was one of the guys that was telling you how it really was. You know, we're talking on a radio and we're using words, but you're leaving out the most important part, which really does change people's minds, is music itself. I mean, eventually they're going to find out that, you know, being a Republican perhaps is a virus, but you're also going to be able to prove at the same time that music does in fact move molecules around and realign them in a way that makes people change their minds, literally.
And speaking of that, and the power of music obviously was a huge part of what happened in the 60s. It was a huge part of the dialogue of what was going on and the exchange of, you know, consciousness that was happening in the 60s. And, you know, there's a lot of people who talk about the 60s now as if they're kind of mildly embarrassed about it. And, you know, like if you remember it, you weren't there. But there doesn't seem to be much conversation about what was possibly valuable about what was going on and what was powerful. What do you think the value of the 60s were? And do you think that some of it has endured into the present?
Well, too bad, not enough of what people were responding to didn't survive. I mean, if they were embarrassed, well, they should be. They probably didn't do what they should have done had they thought about it a lot sooner. You know, so, yeah, I think there's a reason to be embarrassed about why you remember the 60s in a way that makes you uncomfortable, because you probably didn't do the stuff that you made your commitments to, you know, on a deeply personal level. I mean, I don't think that there's anything that happened in that particular generation that is more revolutionary than in any other time. But I do think, and this will happen again, because it's just time for it, that there was in terms of evolution, I don't think that people evolve as much as consciousness evolves. And there comes a time in certain break, you know, where people are going, oh, what is, something is going on. You know? And I think that's about to occur all over again, because you have the same kind of situation. You have a very repressive government situation. You have huge attacks on people, on comedians, and people who are funny being considered dangerous. And then, you know, the music will follow.
What is it about music that has that ability to really stir up the passion and the imagination, do you think?
Well, Well, I think for a lot of people, it's the fact that they recognize they have one, an imagination. You know, it just it taps into that part of you that you didn't know was there for a lot of people. I mean, that's certainly what happened to me. I didn't know what music was. I didn't really think about it.
How did you meet Frank?
At the L.A. airport. But there's no tricks, so you can't try this at home, okay? Good luck with that.
Anyone who just wants to go off to the airport and find the love of their life may be out of luck. Were you pretty flying?
No, he was coming in off a promo tour that had been canceled for I don't remember, but it was probably something to do with, you know, not being able to sell enough tickets or something. And it was right before the release of Freak Out. I was with the girl that was driving his car that he shared a house with, and he had told her, don't bring anyone to the airport, and she didn't listen.
And was it just like love at first sight?
It took me 24 hours to process it.
That long, huh?
maybe it was more like 15 hours or something like that. But for him, you know, he never told me, but I read it in an interview years and years later. But yeah, it was somebody asked him the same question. He said, yes, it was.
Wow. You know, I was thinking about your 28-year marriage through a period of great experimentation, you know, the sexual revolution, people were challenging traditional forms of relationships. What was it about you guys that made it last?
I don't think the challenges made it last. I think it's what you're made out of that makes it last. Huh. And the choices that you make, it's hard work.
Yeah.
And most of it, you know, at the end of, I was lucky because at the end of, I got to see it from the beginning, the middle, and the end. And at the end of the marriage, you know, who I was faced with was myself, but free. And I didn't start out that way. And I owe that to Frank.
What many people seem to be surprised to learn is that he didn't take drugs, right?
Right.
How did he feel about drugs?
Well, he put his thoughts about, certain thoughts about dealing with, you know, people taking drugs in his employment contracts, because you could find yourself in the unemployment line very quickly. Because drugs mean that you put other people in the band at risk when you cross international borders, especially. And it interferes with your ability to pay attention, which is, you know, I think one of the great, most important things that musicians realize and have going on for themselves is that at some point, as a musician, you have to listen. And that's a quality. I think that's the most remarkable quality that Frank had. One of them, you know, the ability to listen.
I'm Rebecca Novick, and you're listening to Experience Talks. We're going to take a break and return in a moment to continue speaking with Gail Zappa. Biggest donors to the Democratic Party for a period.
All I'm really interested in is ending suffering, okay? And this is one of the reasons why I was a donor, because it really was about ending suffering, you know, in physical, real hardcore physical ways, that you could spend money over here and you could get results, and you could spend money over there and you could get results that were beneficial in people's lives, that didn't have the advantages that a lot of the rest of us may have had. And it's there's no one really committed to that concept, you know, that I can see out there. They're just not there for that, not for ending suffering. They still want to have a fight, still want to argue, they still want to build things that hurt people. And all the while, for this defense, which I believe in, you should defend your country, defend your nation, defend the people. But you have to be able to balance that with there's some benefits to the people. You can't starve them and then expect them to stand up and salute the flag and like it, you know. Mm. And I think that, you know, that's one of the reasons why America is basically depressed, I think. I like to watch television to see what they're really pushing. And, you know, they're pushing two things, new cars and a lot of drugs. From a lot of different drug companies. And most of them are for sleep disorders. I mean, quite a lot are for sleep disorders. So, you know, that has to go to your conscience. And I think that it's not about bad people feeling bad about their lives. I think it's about good people feeling bad about their country and being party to things that they didn't choose. So I just have to say, you've got to register to vote. You've got to show up.
You sound optimistic at the same time, and you also talked earlier about how in a few years you felt that there was maybe going to be another wave, not unlike what happened in the 60s. So you feel we're in for a sea change here?
I do think we're in for a sea change, and there's no reason not to be optimistic. I mean, look at Nelson Mandela. Where else can where can you see a greater shining example of what is possible? I mean, it's just a long wait. But at the same time, you know, he said an amazing thing when he was released, that he couldn't hate his captors because he would continue to be their prisoner. And you have to remember that about politics in America. People are making choices not because they're evil, but because they're stupid. And they just need to be shown another option.
So the answers could perhaps come, even possibly from a Republican. Are you saying that you would take the answers if it ended suffering from anywhere?
Well, you know, one thing the Republicans are really good at is infiltration and subversion. So what if somebody infiltrated the Republicans and subverted their policies? You know it's happening. Come on, guys, admit it.
So are you still a big supporter and very involved in the Democratic Party?
No. Too much rhetoric.
Hmm.
There's no one out there right now like
in the
that.
Democratic Party.
No one anywhere right now.
You know, I don't want to end this interview without talking about your project with the Vault.
Oh, yeah.
Because this is just an extraordinary, very devotional project, it seems, for you to go through all the video footage and music that hasn't been released yet of Frank Zappa's. Can you talk a little bit about this project and what we could perhaps see come out from it in the years to come?
Well, thanks for asking about the Vault, because it is really a vault. And I've been working with Joe Travers, who's also the drummer in Zappa Plays Zappa. He is the vault meister, and his job is to go in there and dust all the tapes off and find out what's on them. Certain tapes you can only play. You get one shot at it. So it's quite complicated to archive and maintain everything. But apart from that, you know, there's no way to know what's on a tape. I mean, what the box says doesn't necessarily lead to the truth. It's like a frightening expeditionary quality to the whole process. So
have you found things that have just blown you away?
Oh, yeah. The difficulty is that, you know, people, for us to make it clear to people that we're not trying to make records that Frank would make, but we can collect. There's lots of masters that we find all the time that are edits that Frank has done, you know, where there's maybe three or four tracks kludged together in some way. And we can preserve the things that the composer intended. And that's one of the things that we will do. And then we have the option for lots of live tapes, you know, which can just go out warts and all. And then the other thing that we have in the vault is tons and tons and tons of video footage in the last sort of decade.
And how long do you see this project taking?
Well, we've been at it 12 years, and we've got about 40 projects that we've identified now. So the worst thing that could happen is the dog could run in and piss on one of the tapes or something. that's your worst fear. So, yeah. And that happened to a 24-track one time.
Oh, no.
Yeah. But
so you said some of these tapes, you only get one shot.
Yeah.
Is that because they're in such delicate condition?
It's because there's a certain type of tape, which I never can remember which one it is, that the metallic bits, the glue disappears. Well, some, the glue disappears. It just dries up. And others, it's too sticky, so it'll adhere to the actual tape head when you run it through. So you have to bake these things to get all the moisture out and hope that the material still sticks to the plastic tape that's running through, the metal flakes, and you don't just get everything all over the desktop, you know.
You actually have to heat it.
You have to bake it. Yeah, so, I mean,
wow.
Frank named the studio the Utility Muffin Research Kitchen. I think that he didn't realize how apt it was. Because, yeah, now we're in the baking business. We have an oven. Yeah.
Because it's in your house. Right?
It's under the house.
Under the house.
Yeah, it's the vault. It's literally
the
vault.
Well, good luck with that, and it's been a pleasure talking to you, Gail.
Thank you.